Money, money, money. That is the topic under discussion this morning here at KGNU as part of our quarterly conflict resolution program. Today, we're looking at money, stress and conflicts. I'm your co-host this morning, Maeve Conran, in for Sam Fuqua, our regular co-host, but delighted to have in the studio Mary Zinn. Great to have you, Mary.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
And we have a panel of expert guests this morning, and we hope that you will be inspired to call in and maybe share your experiences or ask a question. I'd like to welcome to the studio Paula Langoth-Ryan, who has been helping consumers resolve financial conflicts for almost 30 years as a senior mediator at Compassionate Mediators. She offers people the tools that they need with allowances, spending patterns, inheritance issues, debt negotiation and credit restoration. And we're linking to her website at kgnu.org. Good morning, Paula.
Good morning, Maeve. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us, we have Damon Day, who has spent more than a decade using his financial education and personal experiences to coach thousands of families through financial hardships. He's one of the country's foremost financial strategists in the debt relief industry. And we're linking also to his website at kgnu.org. Thank you, Damon, for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, Mary Zinn, money, it's sometimes at the heart of so many conflicts at many, many interpersonal levels, often in families, often between friends. And then, of course, we're dealing with money every single day when we're out and about as consumers, as business people, and they often have conflicts as well. What are your initial thoughts on how money can be part of a conflict?
Working with people around money often boils down to trust issues. What do I trust that you're doing? Is it in my best interest, or are you really trying to deny me something I need? And we associate, of course, money with status as well. So there are a lot of issues around ego, a lot of issues around whose money is it? What about families who are ready to have their parents' money while their parents are still spending it? Not a good plan. So there are a lot of interpersonal conflicts around that. And then there are business issues, of course, that need the attention of the other experts at the panel today.
We'll talk about that in a minute, but I do think this is going to be a program that will resonate with so many listeners because you identified so many aspects of life. And particularly if we start off with that family issue, inheritance is something, but also the money that is there while maybe the parents of the older generation are still alive, and how does that get spent in various different things. Paula, you're nodding your head. Is this something that you have come across, families in some type of conflict situation or even often a crisis because of money?
Oh, absolutely. Matter of fact, I can take it real personal. 3 years ago, my mother died unexpectedly. She was 15 years younger than her husband, and they had always assumed he would go first, so they never finished signing their wills. And he has three grown children. We had four grown children, so everything, including my grandmother's estate, went to him and his family. I was fine with that. Some of my other members of my family were a little distressed by that because it was unexpected. And then my father just passed away on Father's Day. And my sister, who's the executor, called me up and she was like, I don't know how to tell you this, but Dad borrowed some money from somebody. And so he took you out of the will. I'm assuming because he knew I was fine. But it was like, it's things like that. If that happens in a family that doesn't know how to deal with these issues that come up, I mean, you have splits in families. I had a client whose husband's brother had gone with her to divide up the family's assets when their last parent died. And the brother was just like, I want this, I want this, I want this, I want this. And the wife was getting really distressed, and she calls her husband. He goes, you know what? He's my brother. He can have whatever he wants. It's just stuff. And as long as you've got someone in the family who's the level-headed, you know, you can resolve some of those conflicts pretty easily. But yeah, inheritance issues are a huge one that go on. They create rifts for generation.
Everyone's nodding their head in the studio. I think we could all share stories on this particular issue. But now, Molly, you have a terrific attitude. And first of all, condolences on the recent passing of your father.
Thank you.
Awful for you to deal with all of that. But many people, they would not laugh or have a good attitude over that. And you say it's just stuff, but many people, that stuff represents love, emotion, my place in the family. And so if I was removed from a will, I'm, you know, and many people might feel I have been removed from the family, I have been left out of this. I mean, is that some of the things that you're dealing with? I mean, how do you as a financial person try to extract the emotion.
Well, the thing I always tell people is it's never about the money. The money is just that symptom. The truth is, it's pushing my buttons of lack and limitation. It's pushing, you know, in mediation, you know, there's no such thing as fair because everybody has their own version of what fair is. But it pushes that button. Abandonment, you know, mom loved you more, dad loved you more. You know, guilt, you know, I wasn't there taking care of them. You were, you know, it could be anything. So it's these core beliefs that we have that's really behind the conflict. The money is just that surface piece that's happening.
Now, you yourself have two experiences, one where your mother didn't leave a will, one where your father left a will, but both equally maybe, you know, rife with conflict. I mean, obviously, leaving your wishes laid out very clear is one way to maybe avoid some of that, but it's also one way to inflict a lot of conflict on other people, depending on what you either leave in or leave out of that will.
Well, that's what happens a lot of times, is people don't want to have the hard conversations with their family, and so they just do. They leave it as a surprise. Now, my sister had been the executor. She had told me in the previous version that I was in the will, and then had called me up and said, you know, I don't know how to say this. And I'm like, honey, it's fine. You know,
most people wouldn't say, honey, it's fine. Exactly. That would not be their initial reaction. And what Paula is talking about with the family communicating, one of the greatest gifts parents can give to their kids, all of them, is to have that conversation, let them know ahead of time what to expect, all of the financial pieces out on the table, so that the kids don't wrangle about it after they pass. That those conversations are critical. And I'm still surprised to hear someone say there was no will. It can be a simple piece of paper with your... Well, I'm not an attorney, so don't take this literally. But what I'm saying is keep it simple if you want to, but create a will. Well, every walking person needs to have a will.
And not only create a will, because my mother, they had created their wills. They just never had them executed. They never went and had them signed.
So could I just ask, Paula, because you did say then... Because of that, then the money went to, I believe, your mother's second husband, or it wasn't your father's family. Yeah. Was there then a conversation about, well, I know your mother really wanted this to happen, even though it's not legally set in stone, so let's maybe ignore what the legal things are and let's just talk about this as a family. Was that ever?
No, there was conversation of, you know, when I sell the house, you know, I'll make sure you kids get some. Well, he just passed away the week after Father's Day. So, you know, and it's the unexpecteds that happen. And people hate to talk about death, and so they hate to do their wills, and they hate to do these things. But when they don't, they create mass chaos, you know, emotionally and financially for so many people. You know, not everyone has the skills and training. You know, if you want those skills and training, I do skills and trainings. Yeah. But, you know, not everyone has that to be able to say it's okay and mean it. You know.
Well, we are talking about the conflicts that can arise and very often do arise from money in families this morning, hearing there from Paula Langoth-Ryan sharing her own experiences. But she is a professional in this area as senior mediator at Compassionate Mediators. Well, Damon Day, you also work with families, not necessarily in the inheritance aspect, but in, you know, when people are alive and they're dealing with money and how that creates conflict. And I know you also are really working in the debt relief industry. Debt is a loaded word, and it can be often a huge burden for families to bear. The debt in and of itself then can create other stress and other conflicts. I mean, what are some of the scenarios that you've seen that you work with people on?
Well, you know, Paula really hit it on the head when she was talking about, you know, when you don't have a will and all this stuff. Sorry, let me back up. This is my first time on radio, so as Paula put it, I'm a radio virgin, and I said, "Look, if you see this panic look in my eyes, take it." So
you didn't look panicked.
I did. I was the panic look with the wink.
Okay,
and
so
I sent
so
it right
let
to
me
you.
Ask you a question then. So let's say someone comes to you, and they are completely stressed out. They're not only not making ends meet, but they're adding to their debt just to pay their daily expenses. So if I'm in that situation and I come to you and it's ruining my marriage and I'm stressed out at job, you know, and my kids, I'm yelling at them and I'm kicking the dog, you know, what are some options that people have to remove those stressors so that they can start to breathe again and be loving and kind to each other?
Okay, so now we're in my wheelhouse. We started talking about wheels and things like that. I'm going, I'm in the wrong studio here. So that's pretty much what I see on a daily basis is people coming to me. By the time they get to me, they are literally, you know, cash flow negative, thousands of dollars a month sometimes. And they're trying to decide, do I pay the credit cards? Do I pay the mortgage? What am I supposed to do? And so when you start looking at options, obviously the big ones that come up, people look at bankruptcy, they look at credit counseling, they look at debt settlement and things like that. And the biggest thing for me when somebody comes to me is sitting down with them and helping them to really understand and think through those options and make the decisions that are you know, financially prudent rather than making decisions based on emotion. And I think you hit on it a little bit earlier where it's such a loaded word, debt, and it's an emotional thing. And the biggest issue people have is they're making those choices based on how they think they feel or how they feel about what they think might happen. And they're really making those decisions just really based out of fear or lack of information. So getting that information and really understanding what options are out there, especially things like bankruptcy. Not that I push bankruptcy all the time, but what I do push is getting educated about whether or not that bankruptcy would make sense. And a lot of people, they'll come to me and they'll say, okay, look, first thing I want you to know is I don't want to file bankruptcy. And I'll say, well, why not? And then I hear this silence, kind of like what you heard from me a second ago. Deer in the headlights, I have no clue why not. I just know I don't want to. And so that's usually where that conversation will start. And then we'll go from there and start to explore what is it about that word bankruptcy that has you so afraid. And then from there, we can start to get to what the real underlying issues are. And then we can talk about whether or not it might make sense and then go from there.
Do you find yourself as much a financial strategist and educator, really a relationship counselor? Because, you know, people have such different attitudes, and you talk there about how people have a knee-jerk reaction to maybe the term or the concept of bankruptcy. And so much of that goes back to childhood, our experience in our own families, and then people often then bring all that baggage, get that big U-Haul and load it all up and bring it to your present relationship. I mean, do you have to really talk people through a lot of that, aside from the financial advice? But really try to, you know, pack apart that the emotion from your personal experience to how this is impacting your current relationship.
Well, I do, but I'm horrible at relationship advice. I'm good with numbers. I've got a finance degree. I've seen Dr. Phil a few times, but I'm horrible at relationship advice. So, you know, Paula is probably much better suited for that because, you know, Paula mentioned it earlier where, you know, the debt is just the symptom. And I'm really good at fixing the symptom. You know, you don't hear people say that a lot, where, oh, I'm just going to address your symptom, I'm not going to address your problem. But that's really what I do. I'm a big believer in do what you're good at. And I'm good at taking a financial problem, thinking outside the box and saying, okay, how can we fix this? What options are out there? I can go get it fixed, get them back to even where they can breathe a little bit. And then I can toss them over to someone like Paula, who can really then dig into, okay, what are these underlying issues? How did this happen? Why did you get there? And what can we do to make sure you're never a client of Damon's again? So that's kind of how I would handle something like that.
So what do you do? I'll address this to Paula. Damon, thanks for that shift over. What do you do to keep people from fighting about the problem they have together? How does that either get toned down or blow up in their face?
Right.
What happens?
I do a lot of couples coaching around money issues, and the biggest thing is to first get them to establish we are a team. You know, like, what name do you want to give your team? It could be your last name, it could be something, you know, obscure like rutabaga, whatever your team name is. But any situation that comes up financially, okay, what are we as a team going to do? And then you talk about the fears that are coming up for each one. Yeah, I mentioned off mic with you that I have a special report. It's a workbook that you can print out two copies of. It's an ebook and a workbook for free on my website. It's called Heal Your Relationship with Money. It was created with a psychologist. And you go through it and you answer these, I think it's 38 questions in depth, as honest as you can. And then you sit down and share your answers with your partner.
Do you have someone else there with you while you share your answers?
Or you can if you want to, but a lot of times people write them down and then they'll just have conversations with each other. Like, you know, it makes me really uncomfortable when someone gives me a big gift. That's why I always turn them down when your family gives us a big gift. I go, no. You know, which you don't like my family. You know, it's a whole different dynamic. It's like, no, here's why I do that. Because when I was a kid, I got a big gift and there were all these strings attached and it meant this, that, or the other, or, you know, whatever was attached to it. But once you get into the story so that people understand, oh, you're not rejecting me. You're a team member who has these issues around money. I'm a team member who has these issues around money. Knowing this, it's like knowing your Enneagram or your Myers-Briggs type. You know how to work with each other better.
One of the things that's going through my mind as you describe this, Paula, is to ask our callers to let us know how they have found ways to deal with this when they are losing trust, when they're arguing, when they have different spending habits, when they get deeply into debt. Do they have resources they go to? Do they find ways to talk with each other? And this could be parents, this could be spouses, this could be roommates, could be anyone. And any kind of suggestions that our callers have are certainly welcome.
Well, we do invite listeners to participate. The number is 303-442-4242, 303-442-4242. You can email dj@kgnu.org and share your experience and also maybe your questions, Paula.
Well, one of the phrases I tell people to use is, this is really hard for me to say, and, or you start a conversation with, I love you and I don't think that's a good choice for us right now. Or I love you and the thought of spending that money on that scares the bejesus out of me.
I like the and instead of but.
Yes.
Because it's usually a but and that raises people, as that goes.
Yeah.
Well, we are talking about money, conflict and stress in so many different scenarios this morning. And there are so many ways that this ties back to when we're children and how we are educated, or rather not educated, about finance. And there's so much discussion about how we are just not financially literate, whether that's a lack of an issue happening at the schools or in our families. And a lot of that time, that relationship starts right at the beginning with maybe an allowance, or that sometimes there's a conflict there between kids want a certain allowance. Parents don't necessarily agree with each other on what allowance. And so any thoughts on that, Paul? Is this something that you have ideas on, and how to start healthy relationships around money right from those early stages?
Well, with the allowance issue, it's even more complicated if there's two families. If there's a divorce and you've got one parent who's giving more as an allowance or less than. So that's really individualized. And the biggest thing is, don't tie it to chores. You know, it needs to be just, okay, this is what's yours to spend, how you want to spend it. My dad was fascinating because what he did was he had us have those little notebooks. So we had to write down our allowance. We had to write down any other income we received from birthdays, babysitting, found money, whatever. So that was our income. Then we had to list our expenses. Now, there could be weeks when all I had was candy, 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 candy. You know, and books. Candy and books. And then you had to show that you still were in a positive balance. You know, if I borrow $5 from my brother, I've got to put that in there. Oh, and my brother's charging me interest. Let's put that in there, you know. And so it taught us a little bit more about how to handle money of our own. But I think a bigger issue around the allowance stuff is, because kids don't usually see us handling money, they have a warped sense of, well, you can afford that, you can afford that. And there was a family in Chicago who did a really great job, because the daughter was constantly, I want this, I want that. So he brought home his paycheck and cashed it, all small bills, and he sat her down at the kitchen table and he said, okay, so here's what I need you to do. Okay, take this money out, that's for the mortgage. Okay, and take this out. This is what mom's going to spend on food each week. This is for the electric. This is for the water. This is, okay, and this $12 is what we have left for discretionary money. Do you want to spend that on this, or do you want to put that toward our Disney World vacation? And she was just appalled. She was like, that's all that's left.
That is such a great idea. I mean, I experienced that with my kids. I want. And it's like, well, where do you think this money comes from? The lady at the bank. I'm like, okay.
The machine in the wall.
The machine, your card. And that's a great idea to actually have it as a tangible thing. Well, we do have some callers waiting to join the conversation. So I'll get folks to pop their headphones on, Mary. And we'll welcome Karen, who's calling in from Boulder, to talk further about wills. Welcome to the show, Karen. What's your question or comment?
Hi. So I was listening earlier and you spoke about sometimes it's best to let the family members know before the death what is actually in the will. We had that happen in our family, and unfortunately what it did was it caused strife in the family before anyone passed away. So now there's this kind of disharmony in our family regarding what's in the will, since everyone now knows what's in the will. And I'm not so sure that that's really the best idea. And is that happening more and more, where people are actually discussing wills before death?
But we're going to get Paula to weigh in on that.
Hi, Karen. Thanks for bringing that up. Did they, just as a clarifying question, did they tell everybody why they were doing the will the way they did?
That's a very good question. Yes, and what it was they were skipping a generation and leaving everything to the grandchildren and skipping the next generation. And I guess that was their only reason, was because they thought that the grandchildren needed it more than the next generation. So,
Well, to bring something up about that, that's actually a huge tax strategy. So they were actually doing it to save both the middle generation, their own children, and their estate taxes. A lot of it would have gotten eaten up by taxes if they'd given it to that generation, whereas if you do a generation-skipping trust, more of it stays in the family. So their hearts were in the right place, but that doesn't always translate well if the kids' generation really is cash-strapped. A lot of times what's best at that point is, if folks are having issues with it, you know, write them all down and present the case of, well, how can we make this happen if there are kids in the first generation that are having a problem financially, because sometimes that can be handled by a separate insurance policy.
Oh, see, I had no idea it was about taxes. That was never mentioned. And then you said it could be handled by a separate insurance policy?
Yeah, a lot of times, because insurance doesn't go through the estate. So right. If they do policies where they pay a premium, you know, either annually or a large sum up front, then that each individual tax or each individual insurance policy can go to the actual siblings without affecting the estate. So, yeah, just sit down and talk with them.
Great, that's very helpful. Thank you. And I do want to make the point, though, that sometimes when information is given, it may create more conflict than what is intended.
Amen to that.
Thank you so much for that call, Karen. It is just coming up on 9 o'clock here at KGNU Boulder, Denver. I'm Maeve Conran with my co-host Mary Zinn of Zinn Mediation Associates this morning. I'm in for Sam Fuqua, who's the regular co-host of our quarterly conflict resolution series. And this morning we're taking a look at conflict and money. And our guests in the studio are Paula Langoth-Ryan, who is with a senior mediator at Compassionate Mediators. And she works with people on all of these issues. We're linking to her website at kgnu.org. Also, Damon Day, who works with families and individuals working around debt relief, and he's one of the country's foremost financial strategists in the debt relief industry. Also linking to his website at kgnu.org. Mary, did you want to jump in following what Karen said?
I did want to mention to Karen and others, when you're surprised by something, it is really off-putting. And it sounds like this information about the will put strife into the family, as you described, Karen. So to get everyone together with the parents who wanted to share this information and describe your concerns, what was everyone concerned about, so it's all on the table. And saying up front, as Paula's mentioned earlier, the relationship is our primary concern. We want to keep our family relationships. Depending on what the history is, that may or may not be the case, but you would hope that looking at that together, all of this information might have come out about why would we choose such a thing for tax purposes, and what can we do to give beneficiaries of a life insurance policy or something like that a direct gift.
And then we'll go to the phones. Paula, you wanted to weigh in.
Well, yeah, a really easy way to resolve it with it, because a lot of times what the question is we ask is, why did they do that? Instead of going into wonderment, which is, I wonder why they did that. And then you're in an open space as opposed to that crossed-armed, you know, toddler. Why did they do that?
Why did they do it to me?
To me, yes.
Exactly, internalize all of that.
To me, right?
Well, we'll go back to the phones, and I would like to welcome callers at 303-442-4242. Email us at dj@kgnu.org. Next, we'll welcome James calling in from Boulder. Welcome to the show. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for calling in. What's your question or comment this morning?
I was going to say I do tactical portfolio design, and I think one of the most powerful things someone can do is to open a Roth IRA as early as they can in their life, and then invest in something like small cap value stocks or mid cap growth. And then by the time they're up in the part of their life where they're, you know, waiting for their elders to pass on, they're not so invested in this kind of money. I know there's other psychological reasons why we, you know, battle over this money, but we grow our money tax-free in this Roth IRA, and we that's ours. Nobody can take it away from us, and it's compounding. And then you have a lot of money on your side, and then you're not maybe so desperate to have this money from the elders. I know certain people have circumstances where they can't accumulate that money because of their job loss and things, but I think the Roth IRA is a very powerful thing, and I would advocate for people to do that.
Okay.
Thanks.
Well, James, thanks very much for calling in, and actually, this reminds me of what you shared, Paula, your own personal experiences, that when you found out you were left out of your father's will, you were like, it doesn't matter because I'm okay because I'm self-sufficient. That's not always the case for people.
Well, also, you have to realize that self-sufficient doesn't necessarily mean I've got a huge amount of money in the bank. It means I know where my good comes from, and I know that I can generate what I need to take care of myself. And I think what happens a lot of times is there's the fear of not enough, and that could be never enough. I had a client once who, you know, thought when she made $1 million, she'd feel financially secure. Then it was two, then it was four. She called me when she got to 9 million, and she still didn't feel financially secure because it's never about the money. But like even a lot of the will stuff, it could be a small inheritance. But what it is it pushes all of these core beliefs about who loved whom most and who was worthy and who was powerless. And so it's a lot, it's never about the money. It could be $1,000 inheritance. And if you don't get your fair share of that, you know, you're wounded to the core unless you heal that stuff.
Well, we'll go back to the phones. And I'll welcome Angie in Boulder. Welcome to KGNU. You're on the air.
Hi, I wanted to go back to where you were talking about kids, and you had mentioned something about allowance, and it should never be linked to chores, and I was just wondering why you think that.
That's a good question, Angie. I was actually going to ask Paula that too, so thanks for calling in.
That's actually a very good question. So chores are a basic part of being a team member in the household. That is your job in the household. I don't get paid for being the mom. You don't get paid for being the kid. But you do get allowance just for being part of the family. You know, because the minute I tie it to chores and you say, take out the trash, you don't get your allowance. Well, I don't feel like taking out the trash. You know, mm-hmm. I'm babysitting now. I don't need that. So I'm not going to do my stuff around the house. And it's like, that doesn't work that way. Does that help?
That's a very interesting point. Yeah, when I grew up, we had like a point and minus system, and that was what our allowance was based on. So we had things that we weren't paid for, but then we had a whole host of things that equaled our allowance. So I just wanted to hear what your point of view was. So thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that call, Angie. The number to call is 303-442-4242. Email your questions to dj@kgnu.org. Ask a question, maybe share your own experience on conflict and money. My co-host this morning, Mary's in with Mediation Associates. And money is also one of those things that as families or when we get together, we say, let's not talk about it. Money, politics, religion. And I often think that does a disservice because then that leaves so much unsaid. And as what we're hearing this morning is, it's not so much the money, it's the lack of communication.
Absolutely. And so we back off. We're afraid we'll get into a conflict with someone instead of being able to think we have the skills to work through it. Whatever comes up, we will learn how to work through that, whether it is money, politics, religion, or family values, or whatever we're talking about. And I think even Paula's example of a conversation about allowance, you know, what is being a family team member? What is that like? What do we all need to commit? And family vacations are a great way to test that out. Everybody's part of the team. When we're on vacation, you give up a little, you give up a little. Maybe everybody gets to do the one thing that they thought would make this vacation a huge success for them. But everything else is negotiable. We're going to see how this plays out. So you're the team member. I also wanted to mention a fifth grade program that my grandson went through related to money and knowing about it. Polly, you were describing how your father helped you know about money and the piece with the money all laid out. I cannot remember, and maybe one of our listeners will, the name of this program for fifth graders, but they actually have an education about a bank account, and they get $12, something like that, interesting number, and they can spend it, but they have to know that if it's gone, it's gone, and they can't overspend. They're not invited to do that. In the opposite extreme, my granddaughter didn't know the value of money and used a $20 bill to decorate one of her art pieces. So that was a lot of fun. Her mother was trying to explain to her, no, honey, that little piece of paper has some value. So by the time you get to fifth grade, you get a better sense of that.
Well, at what age would you suggest, Paula, starting kids on an allowance? And, you know, how much then do you give?
I wouldn't say it's so much an age as it is an awareness. If they can identify and accurately count and tell you the denominations and how to make change, then they're ready for an allowance. I mean, my son's almost 9 and we haven't put him on an allowance yet. He just started getting that whole concept really recently. He actually created a parking meter job for himself, and we found tickets on our windshields in the garage. And then when I didn't pay the ticket, I found my car booted, which consisted of my hiking boot in front of the tire.
That's very enterprising. I'm sure you were proud.
I paid him in photocopies of the front of $5 bills, $45, and I printed out parking permits for us to put in our vehicles.
Well, that's parenting expert and mediator Paula Langoth Ryan, one of our guests this morning here at KGMU, as we talk about money and conflict as part of our quarterly conflict resolution series. Our other guest, Damon Day, is one of the country's foremost financial strategist in the debt relief industry. And Damon, I know it's your first time on radio. You're doing a great job, so you know I'm going for you again. But we were talking earlier about debt, such a loaded word, such emotional baggage that many people have. Are you finding that people are making major life decisions around debt? Because we hear these news reports that people are getting married later, are not getting a house, are choosing to have children later because they have debt, or a spouse or a partner has debt, and that can really interfere with a relationship.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things, we haven't brought it up yet, but the biggest thing that I'm seeing in terms of interfering with life is student loans right now. 10 years ago, most of my clients were all, I had credit card debt and I need help with this and should I go bankrupt? And now I would say almost 75% of my clients are calling me about student loans, either the parents that have loans for their kids or parents that still have loans for themselves from 30 years ago or the kids. And, you know, you're hitting it right on the head as far as, you know, they'll call up and story after story. I don't feel like I can get married. I can't move out of the house. I'm still living with my parents. I'm 28 years old and I can't start my life. And even some on the more serious side where they're talking about, I feel suicidal and things like that. So it and this is just, again, all about, it's just debt. Even student loan debt is still just debt. And there are ways to deal with it. And so, yeah, that's the over the last 5, 6, 7 years, that has just really become a major issue for a very large segment of the country.
Well, that in and of itself, it's its own show in terms of, you know, what's driving all of that debt. But you talk there about often parents taking out the debt on behalf of the students.
Yeah.
Is that something that as a financial strategist that you would, you know, recommend? I mean, we hear a lot about the debt on the part of the student, and if you're a young person starting your life out with debt, that's one thing. And I know many parents then want to alleviate that type of pressure and say, well, we'll take on the debt. But then that can cause conflicts in and of itself because your debt is related to somebody else's life.
Yeah. See, this is really more of an individualized kind of question. You can't really generalize it. But, you know, this is my personal opinion, but you know, college, it's like we're in the society now where it's like if you want your kids to be successful, they have to go to college. It's the pressure is put on the parent. And then we've got, without getting too technical, access to all this easy money with government and private banks getting in there. With, I don't want to get into all the reasons why private banks are getting into it, but it's very easy to get kids to college. And, you know, not everybody has to go to college. College isn't what it used to be. And so my best advice for a parent with, you know, 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds kids getting ready to go into college is really have a plan first. Don't just go to college to go to college. You know, there's other alternatives too. There's trade schools, there's community colleges. College can really add up really quickly, and it's really easy just to sign that note, send your kids to college before you know it, 4 years later, 6 years later, 7 years, they finally graduate, and all of a sudden, oh, I've got $300,000 in co-signed student loans or federal loans that we've taken out, and now you've got a parent that's maybe in their 60s and they're trying to retire and they can't because they owe all this money and their kids still living at home with them and they can't get this $100,000 a year job that the you know they thought they would get when they got this degree. So the best thing they could do is really have a plan and understand what you're doing and think about the value. How much are we going to have to pay for this? And what's the real value of this specific degree that we're going to get? And is it worth it? Because some degrees these days, just they're not worth it. You know, you got to look at it like any other investment. Does it make sense to invest this money before you sign that loan?
And very often, I think the relationship itself needs to be examined. It's like, are you then assuming that, okay, you're co-signing on this loan with your kids, but are you expecting your kids to pay it off? And this gets back to what we talked about earlier with inheritance and maybe that communication that needs to happen before any of this ever gets signed. Damon?
Yeah, so I got, my father taught me a long time ago, I don't even remember how old I was, but he told me that if you're going to give a family member a loan, make it a gift. In your mind, you give them a gift. If they pay you back, that's just a bonus. But if you're going to loan money to family, it's got to be a gift. And if you're not willing to give the gift, don't loan it. So when it comes to co-signing, I know it's a sticky issue, especially with parents, because they always want to do right by their kids. But if you're a parent and you're going to co-sign on a student loan, you have to look at that as if, okay, this is going to be a gift for my kid because they might not get a job. They might not be able to pay it back. And is it worth the relationship? I've seen so many families torn apart over student loans, and, you know, estranged parents, estranged uncles, and, you know, the aunt would come in, oh, I'll co-sign for little Johnny, because my credit's better, and now they don't speak anymore. I mean, there's a whole host of issues that goes along with that. So when you're going to co-sign, just like co-signing for a car, you have to really look at that and say, unless you're willing to take on that loan yourself, you shouldn't. You know, look at community college, look at a trade school. If they're not ready to go there yet, then, you know, don't spend $30,000 for the semester.
And it seems, and then considering then instead of giving a loan, you're giving a gift, that releases a lot of that emotional baggage and that expectation of, I will get paid, you know, back. And then over 30 years, that builds up into more and more, you know, drama. Paula, you wanted to weigh in?
Well, just to clarify something David said, the conflict between the people, the parent and the student, or in one case it was a student and the grandmother, isn't necessarily because of the conflict in their relationship. It's that lovely third party, the creditors. I mean, his grandmother was like 90 or something, and the creditors were calling 7, 8, 9 times a day, threatening to come get her and put her in jail. And his loan was in deference. It just was being recorded incorrectly, and so it was showing that he was, you know, basically defaulting on his loan, and she was terrified, you know, but it wasn't because of anything with their relationship. It was this, you know, creditors will lie to you in so many ways to try and convince you.
Well, we'll talk more about those loans and what happens when family members give loans or you give loan to a friend in just a moment. I'd like to remind our listeners that we are here at KGNU with about 15 minutes left with our guests this morning, Paula Langoth-Ryan and Damon Day. And of course, my co-host, Mary Zinn of Zinn Mediation Associates, talking about money and conflict. And so what about that issue? We've talked a lot about families and how it really can generate so much conflict. If a friend asks you for a loan, not even that much, does this same rule apply, Damon? Give that money thinking it's a gift, and if you get paid back, it's a bonus?
Yes.
Short answer is yes.
Okay, well, there you go. That's short and sweet. We have some calls coming in, but also we do have an email from somebody who said that the program that Mary mentioned is the Young Americans Bank, and it's with the Young Americans Center for Financial Education. Linda's daughter went through it, and she says it's phenomenal with budgeting, and her daughter actually is now 25 and is phenomenal at budgeting. So that program, again, Young Americans Bank. Thank you very much, Linda, for emailing us there. We are here at KGNU this morning, and the number to call is 303-442-4242. We'll go back to the phones. And hello. Welcome, Mike from Denver. Good morning.
Hi,
you're on the air.
Boy, this program deserves like 3 straight hours at least. It's really important stuff. Everybody has their war stories, but this is really important information because I remember, you learn a lot of things the hard way. unfortunately, indebtedness, don't try not to do that, et cetera, loaning money. I remember many years ago I loaned money to a former friend because their house was going to get foreclosed. And, it wasn't that much, but, it wrecked our friendship because I wasn't at interest. It was, less than $2,000, but it took 4 years to get it back. It took over a year to get $20. She just never could dig out of it. It wasn't malicious or anything, and I learned don't loan money to friends or family. You just give it, and it's a gift, and it actually says on the check, gift, and that way there's no hard feelings, and you don't wreck relationships. But geez, this is just, it reminds me of a book that I have not read, but I probably should get and read. It's a book by a philosopher from San Francisco State University named Jacob Needleman, I believe was the name. It's called Money and the Meaning of Life, and it's a meditation on all aspects of money. And this permeates absolutely everything. And I hope you do a follow-up on this, because even if you haven't had a lot of callers, I think another thing, too, a lot of people don't like to think about it because it's inherently a tricky, tricky subject, and that's why a lot of people get into debt, because they're not really thinking about what they're doing, what compound interest really implies, et cetera, et cetera. But thank you for the program. I should have made a note. I had another thought here, but I really appreciate this.
Great. Well, good to have you on the air. Thanks, Mike, for calling in. We still have just over 10 minutes left if we do have other callers who want to share, as Mike says, their war stories, because everyone has them when it comes to money and conflict. 303-442-4242. But one of the things that we haven't talked about, we're talking a lot about interpersonal relationships, but then we also are dealing with money with people we have no personal relationship with, either vendors, we're going into stores, as you mentioned earlier, Paula, creditors and various different things. And so I think we're in a society where we think litigation will solve everything. If we have a problem, we'll sue someone. And I don't need to name who maybe is leading that charge in the country. But what do we do with these sort of conflicts that arise, maybe if we're out and about and it's not, that interpersonal? So the relationship isn't adds key to us. We don't necessarily need to preserve the relationship, but it can cause an awful lot of stress and conflict within our lives and different things. I mean, does anybody have advice, Damon? Put you on the spot again.
I thought this was a Paula question. You were going right her way.
We just like to tease you.
Yeah. Anytime you use the word interpersonal, that's going to Paula.
So if it has to do with,
or Mary,
you get a call and you're feeling threatened, and you don't know whether they're telling you the truth or not, what are ways to handle those calls? What do you do?
Well, what I do is I tell people, just immediately go, oh, okay, I don't know much about that. Like, I don't know if I'm actually behind on that thing or something. Could you send that to me in writing? Because a lot of times what happens is there's phantom debt, something, a medical bill that was missed that you paid off, or you were having a hard financial time and you thought you caught everybody and got everybody or included everyone in your bankruptcy, but here's this one guy saying, oh no, you still owe me. You can't make a snap decision. So it's like, okay, can you send me that information? And then educate yourself. Sometimes debts are uncollectible because of the time, or they weren't yours to begin with. Or in a case of a lot of things happening now, we've had a lot of good success with it because in the last 2 years, Chase Bank in particular, and I wrote about it on my blog, started issuing 1099s where they were canceling people's debts that had already been charged off and stuff, which meant you now had to report this as income on your taxes. So you report it as income on your taxes, and then you go pull your credit report, and it's still there. And then you're getting harassing phone calls from a collection agency that Chase has sold it to. Well, working with the Consumer Federal Protection Bureau, they changed all the acronyms
CFPB.
And stuff. CFPB. We've gotten them not only to start putting cases against with the attorney general state by state, but now Chase has started just automatically going, oh, you know what, our bad, and taking it off the credit reports. But they won't do it unless you take the first step and report them. And so we've had really good luck with helping people negotiate that stuff off their reports. Because you've already paid the tax or you've reported it as taxable income, even if you didn't owe tax, they can't come back. And the only reason they keep doing it, as I mentioned it earlier this morning to Damon, is, when they lose in a lower court, they don't appeal. Because if they appeal, it becomes appellate law, and now we can make case law out of it, and Chase and the other banks lose. So the minute they lose, but they rely on people being so scared of going to court that they just let them get a default judgment. And so we do a lot of stuff with folks that are coming to us going, oh God, I just got served papers. What do I do?
Well, and this really ties into, you say, the foreclosure epidemic as well, because people are in this quagmire of paperwork and legalities with banks, and they don't understand it. And very often there is not very legal things happening, illegal things happening on the part of the bank. And because you feel you don't have that voice or you don't have the resources to get an attorney. I mean, Damon Day, you work around debt relief industry. Are these things that people can take on their own? Or do you need to have a mediator or an attorney or somebody else to really be in there fighting your corner?
Well, I mean, absolutely. Consumers, depending on who they are, can usually take this stuff on their own. It just depends on their personality. But kind of piggybacking off of what Paula was talking about, you know, what most people don't realize is, especially if you're getting hounded by debt collectors, you actually have more power over those debt collectors than you realize, because you have what they want. So in any transaction, that's what I was explaining to my clients, there's always a buyer and there's a seller in any transaction. And the buyer always has the power. Right, unless you relinquish it by telling the car dealer that, oh, this is the greatest car ever and I want to buy this car, you lose that power. But up until that point, the seller's already got their cards on the table. You know, so the seller is the creditor or the collector in this case. You know what they want. They want money, but you're the buyer as the consumer. You're the one that has the money that they want. So you've got power and control over that debt collector. Most people cower and, oh my gosh, the creditors are calling me. You know, early on in my career, I used to do a lot of coaching. I would coach people through how to, exactly what you're saying. Can they do this themselves? Absolutely. I'll negotiate or coach you through it. And it got to the point where I just had so many people saying, oh, that's all well and good. You told me everything, but I just can't pick up the phone and do it. Can you do it for me? And after a while, I finally was like, why don't I just do it? And that's kind of how I transitioned into just negotiating for clients on their behalf. But they can absolutely do it. You just have to realize it just comes down to they want money and you have the power to give it to them or not give it to them.
So how do you exercise that power? I mean, what do you say? A debt collector is calling you, like, I think, Paula, you mentioned this scenario where a grandmother had co-signed on a student loan and she's in her 90s getting calls 9 times a day, people threatening to come and put her in prison. I mean, what do you do then?
So, Paula mentioned this earlier, what she said as far as getting them to put it in writing is always good. If you know you owe the debt and say you're trying to settle it, the scenario I always like to tell people to use is use the scenario of just first ask them, well, what can we do to work this out? I don't have $5,000. Well, what can we do? And then, you know, the debt collector, well, what do you have? And, well, I don't know. I'm just, you know, whatever your story is. I'm paycheck to paycheck. Of course, you can embellish a little bit if you want to. The debt collector's never going to know. But I always take the approach of, it's not you that has the money. Because as soon as you say, oh, I've got a 401k or an IRA or something like that, the next question is always, well, how much do you have in there? And then you lose that power. So it's always, I always take the approach of, well, here's all my hardships. Here's what's going on. I'd like to resolve this, but I don't have the $5,000. I might be able to borrow some money from a family member. I don't know for sure, but I might be able to. And they'll say, well, how much do you think you can borrow? I don't know. And then you lowball, you know. You say, I don't know. I don't know if this isn't even, you know, possible, but I might be able to get $1,000. Oh, no, they'll him and Han, they'll do all their things or whatever. But again, you still have the power. And then you tell them, well, you know, what can you do? And they'll come right off that $5,000, usually, you know, down to $2,500 or whatever. And then it's just good old-fashioned haggling and negotiation. But you always use that phantom third party as, well, I don't know, I don't think they can give me that. And then you're never able to get put on the spot as far as you're a loser, why don't you pay this, you've got the money. It's never about you. It's just like in real estate, if you're a landlord and you're trying to raise the rent, you always have this phantom investor. I'm sorry, it's not me. I love you guys. You're great. But the investor says we have to raise the rent $200. There's no investor, but, you know, you can use that to come to resolution. And you can usually always reach a resolution because the collector just wants money. If they don't get anything, they lose. So they want something.
Well, we just have about 5 minutes left this morning here at KGNU as we are in our quarterly resolution series this morning talking about money and conflict. Mary Zinn of Mediation Associates, as always, our co-host this morning. And all of this seems to just tie back to relationships, Mary. And we really focused a lot of the show on that interpersonal, what happens in families, what happens in marriages, what happens between parents and kids and even amongst friends when money can get in the middle.
In a general way, this really applies to conflict across the board. Paula mentioned something earlier about curiosity, essentially, that when someone comes to you with a conflict, especially about money, that you ask questions, that you engage in the conversation to get more information and see how it can be worked out, bottom line. And that's true for all conflicts. Tell me what's the problem. You're not the problem. You're not the enemy. We have a problem to look at together.
We started the conversation talking about wills because that, an inheritance, because that seems to really drive so many family conflicts, and not just in one generation. That is something that trickles down through many, many generations. And sometimes that is due to different attitudes towards money across generations. I mean, both of you, Damon and Paula, do you see that, that attitudes have shifted towards money from one generation to another, particularly around this issue of debt? Because I've met so many people who just feel, well, what's another 10 grand in debt because I already owe 150,000, whether their parents would be horrified at owing $20. I mean, is that an issue as well, just that basic attitude towards money?
I don't know about, I can't speak for Paula, but I definitely see a generational thing there with exactly what you were saying, where you, especially with the younger generation, and, you know, I don't know if it's, you know, going through the bailouts and stuff like that and the stuff the country's gone through the last 10 or 15 years, and it's just really changed. But even things are like, you know, with bankruptcy, you know, 30 years ago, people didn't even want to utter the word, and you know, now we can talk about that with the foreclosure crisis and things like that. And, you know, it almost got to the point of people almost bragging about, you know, oh, I got my house for half price, and, you know, it's just something that's, they're more open, the younger generation is more open, I think, to talking about debt, especially student loans. Student loans, people are bragging on Facebook about, oh, I got you beat, I got 300,000, I got 400,000. And, you know, the older generation, I mean, they would be mortified about talking about how much debt they actually
have.
But
does that then cause conflict in families where you have maybe parents or grandparents who have one attitude, and then maybe using things like wills or inheritance to, I don't say punish, but to kind of coerce some kind of behavior from the kids?
Well, sometimes there's a little bit of that. But what I see more of because of the type of clients I have is, you know, a client, the family was very, very wealthy. And then some stuff happened. And then they became less wealthy, and as it got dispersed. And then, you know, the early 2000s hit and got less wealthy. And so what's happening is, like, okay, the grandparents were really well off, so they were paying for the grandkids' private tuition and stuff. The grandkids die, or the grandparents die, there's nothing left. And now all of a sudden the parents are left, okay, well, how do we keep our social standing? And so then they, even though they'd never had debt to begin with, are taking on all this debt to keep up with the Joneses, to not take something away from their children. I worked with a woman once who both of her sons were in their mid to late 20s. She was making over $100,000 a year, but unable to make ends meet. So we did a whole budget. Well, it turned out one of her sons was getting a little over $30,000 from her. And, you know, she was helping pay the rent, the car payment, the insurance, his therapy, you know, because they'd gotten divorced and, you know, it had traumatized the boys. So, and the other one was getting over $35,000. And so she had to learn strategies to be able to say, no, you know what? It's probably not in my best interest to give you my used car that's still worth $8,000 instead of turning it in and putting that toward the down payment on the new car I'm getting, you know, to wean them off. And so we did, the Bank of the Mom is closing as of this day. And we had, like, every month, a different thing would go bye-bye. And she was terrified that, you know, they'd hate her. And the one son did try and manipulate it a little bit, but he quickly realized, no, this was best for everybody. And, like, my son likes to say, you know, I hate it when you empower me. You know, we don't like it when we get empowered and we have to do stuff for ourselves, but we do like it. So it's a catch-22. So, yeah, dealing with debt, you know, whatever the generation is, whatever's happening, is just really important. Just own it. Just talk about it like you would talk about your favorite football team or whatever. It's just energy. We give it all this meaning. Nothing has any meaning unless you give it to it. So stop giving it meaning. Say it's a 500-pound purple gorilla instead of $300,000 in student loan debt. You know.
Well, as Mike, our earlier caller, said, we could talk for 3 hours on this topic, and I'm sorry I didn't get to our last caller, Robert, at the end there. But please do weigh in at the comment line, 303-447-9911. And I think we shall have to continue this conversation either on conflict resolution or our weekly economics show. But I would like to thank our guests, Paula Langoth-Ryan. Her website is paulalangothryan.com. We're linking to that at kgnu.org. She's a senior mediator at Compassionate Mediators. Also joining us, Damon Day. His website is damonday.com. He's one of the foremost financial strategists in the debt relief industry. As always, our co-host in our conflict resolution series, Mary Zinn of Zinn Mediation Associates. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Maeve, for stepping in, and thanks to our callers.